Welcome to MindWorks. This is your host, Danielle Cerfetti. Culture, inclusion, consciousness, diversity, empathy, community. Leadership today is not only about setting a vision for the road ahead and a business plan to execute against it, but it is also about building a culture and a mindset that makes business success possible. As a special two-part conversation in MindWorks series on leadership, today I am honored to have two global thought leaders who will join me for a discussion on this new and radical way to look at leadership and how doing good actually leads to doing well. Dr. Raj Sisodia is a distinguished university professor of conscious enterprise and chairman of the Conscious Enterprise Center at the Tecnológico de Monterrey in Mexico. He is also a co-founder of Conscious Capitalism, Inc., and has published 15 books, many of them bestsellers, including the New York Times bestseller, Conscious Capitalism, Liberating the Heroic Spirit of Business, the Wall Street Journal bestseller, Everybody Matters, and his last book, The Healing Organization, Awakening the Conscious of Business to Help Save the World. Dr. Sisodia has consulted with and taught at numerous companies such as AT&T, Verizon, Kraft Food, Whole Foods, Tata, Siemens, Spring, Volvo, Walmart, McDonald's, and IBM. His work is an inspiration to many business leaders around the world today, including yours truly. Kelly Lockwood Primus is Chief Executive Officer of Leading Now, a global consultancy that guides current and future leaders in creating more equitable organizations. As an expert on inclusive leadership and cultural dynamics, Kelly has worked with CEOs and executive leadership from Fortune 500 and Global 1000 companies to identify barriers and develop solutions that help change behaviors and company culture. Kelly also shares her knowledge around the world about diversity and inclusion and leadership and how these topics intersect with her own experience as a business person. She doesn't just consult, she actually practices. A thought leader and contributor to Forbes, Kelly harnesses her passion, knowledge, and expertise and finds it exciting and personally fulfilling to be guiding businesses on the right course to achieve their culture and diversity goals. Raj and Kelly, welcome to MindWorks. What a gift it is to have you both on MindWorks at the same time.
Thank you so much for inviting me. Appreciate being here.
Happy to be with you, Daniel.
You're very welcome. So let's have some fun together. Let me ask you first to introduce yourself, not via the bio, the very shortened bio, I must add, that I had to read to our reader right now. But how did you come to what you are doing today? Kelly, your professional trajectory has led you to your current position. And so what is it that you do as CEO of Leading Now?
You know, it's a great question. Sometimes I question that myself. I think the best way to answer that question is it's a balance. Right? I spend part of my time problem solving for the organization, for clients, and sort of getting into the midst of identifying solutions. But on the flip side, as someone leading an organization that's about building leaders and building inclusion, you got to keep your eye on the horizon. So I spend part of my time thinking about what's coming next. What should we be paying attention to? Versus, you know, the day-to-day, how do we get it done? How do we make sure organizations are really thinking strategically about how to build the kinds of leadership and the kind of culture that they want? Some days I'm looking, you know, far out the window, and some days I'm buried head down, really getting into details. So it's an interesting role. I didn't know I'd end up here when I started my career. It's probably some of the most passionate work that I've done so far.
Thank you for sharing that. I'm going to tell a secret to our audience here. Most of the people working for you in your organization are women. Is that a random number, or is that a random observation, or is there a purpose to that?
So percentage-wise, you're right. There are more women in the organization than there are men. Do know that I took leadership of the organization just a couple of years ago. Many of them were already on staff. And then a couple of years ago when all of this happened, the organization is currently part of a merge of two different organizations. One was called Leading Women. So that organization was staffed and led by women only. Okay. And the other organization was a blend. And so right now, as you look at us in this newly merged organization, yes, there are definitely more women on staff and more women consultants. We do a lot of work with women in leadership. But what we've learned is that many of the challenges that women have are also faced by underrepresented populations. So it ended up being sort of a perfect blend, but you're right. There are more women on staff, but doesn't mean we're not paying attention to what goes on past gender.
I was actually making that as an interesting observation because a lot of the organizations, in a sense, have to get in touch, I believe, today with their feminine side in a super positive way. And I think it's not, you know, the emphasis on diversity and inclusion and participation, and that angle certainly is reflected by the composition of your staff. Raj, you wrote important, really paradigm-shifting books, such as Conscious Capitalism, The Healing Organization, and you look at it as the enterprise, as the society of the organization. My question to you is that what is the role that leaders and leadership play in those new constructs?
Well, it's a critical role, really. I mean, without leadership, you don't define what an organization is about or what it's going to focus on and what it can achieve. So I think the role of leaders is central, you know, and building on what you were just talking about with Kelly, you know, this whole theme of the feminine and the elevation of the feminine has been a major part of my work as well. So in fact, when I wrote Firms of Endearment, one of the things that I observed in there, I mean, people use words like caring and compassionate and, you know, conscious and so forth to describe those cultures. And I said, there's a lot more feminine energy in these companies than you find in typical companies. And that led me to more explicitly study that. And I wrote a book called Shakti Leadership, which is embracing feminine and masculine power in leadership. And it's about the idea of wholeness, that ultimately we need to cultivate wholeness, which is simultaneously integrating the masculine and feminine within all of us. You know, you don't have to be a woman or a man, but regardless of what gender you have, you can show up as a whole person. Because as Carl Jung said, every man has an inner woman, every woman has an inner man, right? So it's really what we have done systematically in society is suppress that feminine side, the caring side, the nurturing side, in men and women. And of course, we have sidelined women, and women did not have the right to vote until 100 years ago and couldn't own property for a very long time, and even in this country and so forth. So I think this is the century where all of that is going to change and is changing rapidly. And it's finally, my friend Lynn Twist uses the metaphor of the bird of humanity has been flying with one wing tied behind its back for millennia, the century when that other wing gets unfurled and the bird of humanity can soar higher and go further because of that long overdue change. So I think this is very much about being whole, a whole human being, integrating those sides. In India, as you know, we have gods, many, many gods, right? And each of them is symbolic of something. And one of them is called the Ardha Nareshwar, which is a depiction of a figure with one side of the body being masculine and the other side being feminine. Mm-hmm. And the idea is we are born with these genders for various purposes, but that ultimately our journey in this lifetime is towards wholeness. So it is about bringing that caring, nurturing side to the fore for somebody who's born a male, and is bringing the other elements, you know, the discipline and courage and all of that to the forefront as well. So I think all of that is part of this journey for me. And really the real crystallization of that came a few years ago in 2018 when I worked with a coach for the first time. And when I told her the trajectory of my work leading up to 2005, before that I had done very conventional kind of academic, you know, strategy and all of that kind of stuff. And then everything that happened after that with these books, she said, do you realize that you were trying to impress your father for 45 years? You spent the last 15 years honoring your mother with your work. But you're really bringing her energy and what she stood for into business and leadership. And that was a really clarifying thing for me, because it indeed, if I think about it now, that was kind of the differentiation in a way. This is something that is needed in the world. and I happened to embody more of my mother's qualities than I did my father's qualities. And it came naturally to me to try to bring some of that.
Thanks for sharing that. It's amazing how the intimate and the personal has projected onto the corporate and the enterprise and the business. And that's really what it is about. We are talking about all these characteristics that normally we associate even at the intimate level with an individual or a person. And now we are looking at those qualities, consciousness, you know, all these things at the corporate level. Let me just deviate a little bit here. But again, going back to the role of leaders and leadership in all these models, in a sense, I remember about 25 years ago, when the internet started to emerge and the world realized that people are going to be very connected, hyper-connected, directly, point to point, not having to go through the normal hierarchies of societies and corporations, people have started to advocate the death of leadership. I remember even reading an article entitled like that, that because people can have instant access to information and instant access to each other, who needs a leader to coordinate all that? And so is leadership still relevant today when our colleagues, our employees, our citizens can basically have access to anything they need to do their work? What is the role of leadership in all that? Are leaders becoming obsolete?
You know what? I think leaders are even more critical now than they were 25 years ago, specifically because there is such a plethora of information out there. How do you know what's real? How do you know what's true? Just because you can, you know, Google it doesn't mean it's the right answer, right? So you think about the lack of trust in the news, the lack of trust in information that's being put out there. How do you help people who are so divided in their beliefs and their thoughts come to agreement on something, even, you know, within an organization? I think leadership and demonstrating that ability to help bring different perspectives together and coming up with a solution that works for hopefully all is one of the most critical things we need right now. And so I'd advocate it's even more important today for leadership skills and capabilities and competencies to be taught and to help leaders take charge and help their organizations who are looking for the right answer.
I agree with that. You know, the fact is that human beings have evolved tremendously, and not only all the technology we have access to, but if you look at human intelligence, if you look at the research that has been done on IQ, the Flynn effect is called, right? James Flynn's an intelligence researcher who looked at IQ data, which normally gets standardized, the IQ results every decade. So 100 is always the average. But if you look at the raw data, there's an underlying trend of 3.5 to 4% increase per decade in IQ over the last 80 years that he looked at the data, right? So it's a compounded 3.5% per decade. So what that means is that the average person today would be in the top 2% of intelligence 80 years ago, right? Just given that. So we are more intelligent just in terms of analytical capacity. We are more educated than ever before. We are more conscious than we have been in our history as human beings. I mean, that's a continuous evolution that we are on. So the human seed has never been more potent. Ordinary people are capable of extraordinary things. Your average person today would have been considered a genius 80 years ago. And so people are capable of extraordinary things, but we still need leadership to coalesce all of that extraordinary potential into something meaningful. One of my favorite thinkers is Peter Drucker, and he said, there are only three things that happen naturally in organizations: friction, confusion, and underperformance. And everything else takes leadership, right? So you could take the most brilliant, thoughtful, caring, concerned people, put them in a room, come back 2 hours later, you will find friction, confusion, and underperformance. Until somebody steps into the role of leader, somebody takes on the awesome responsibility of leadership, which means creating a vision for what is possible, where do we want to go together. And a great leader can see beyond the horizon to possibilities that others don't even imagine. And then how do we get there? How do we use our collective capabilities? And now we know people have so much that they can offer, right? So there's just so much there that we can tap into. But it still takes that coalescing energy of the leader, right, to harness that and then to align it and point it in a direction that is going to elevate everybody and is going to create meaning and purpose for everybody.
I like that you reinforce something that Kelly said earlier about this notion of the leader as an ambiguity remover or a clarity provider, if you prefer, that notion that there is so much. Even if our individual intelligences have gone up, as you pointed out, in the past 100 years or so, but there is so much out there that there's that thirst for clarity about what is, but also clarity about what could be. And that basically becoming the role of the leader. And actually, I have a question for you. We'll return to that theme a little later. COVID, in the past 2.5 years, if anything, there's been a lot of ambiguity and uncertainty introduced in our societies, our companies, our markets, etc. Have you seen firsthand a shift in the role of the leader and the meaning of leadership during those 2.5 years of pandemic? What are some of the shifts or the trends you have seen in terms of what qualities leaders are being asked to show?
Well, I think we've seen an elevation of empathy and understanding of our mutual vulnerability and a recognition of what really matters. Now, I think putting the well-being of people at the center of what we've prioritized, I think the best leaders have done that. It is about protecting the people in a physical sense, first of all, maintaining their health and safety, but also protecting them in terms of livelihood. I mean, there's some pretty amazing and heroic stories that I've seen about the lengths to which companies have gone to try to make sure that, you know, people are going to be okay. And I think that has really, it's kind of opened the heart and awakened the sense of interconnectedness, interdependence, and shared vulnerability that we all have as human beings. We've recognized how connected we are and how vulnerable we are in this time. And of course, it has also led us to innovate more rapidly than any time in recent history. We have made changes within a matter of weeks that normally would take months or years. You know, as they say, we have pivoted in so many ways. We have discovered the ability to cooperate with others, competitors, you know, within the same industry or with other industries or with the government and so forth. There's been a higher level of cooperation, I think. So we've exercised certain muscles, I think, in this pandemic in terms of rapid change, innovation, cooperation, caring, that I think will hold us in good stead as we go forward, because this is not the last pandemic. There will be others. And of course, we have got the largest pandemic of all, which is climate change, which is an ongoing slow pandemic, but accelerating. And we're going to have to apply what we have learned in a much larger way as we go forward.
Kelly, I want to hear your take on what Raj just commented on. What have you seen?
Bravo, absolutely right. The last couple of years absolutely has required current leader 2020 to start recognizing that the style of leadership needed to change and actually started changing. You know, we've talked about this many times over the years, and the reality of it is, if you look back when we were talking about 25 years ago and what did leaders look like back then and what was expected of them, and having been in business back 25 years ago, and that's just the last time I'll talk about how old I am, there were many qualities that I had to suppress as a woman leader that is now being coveted by male leaders who are now demonstrating these skills and saying it's so important to be empathetic and it's so important to listen and on. And you're looking at them going, we've been talking about this forever, guys. It's about time, right? It's about time you recognize what it takes to be a full, whole leader. So I absolutely agree with Raj. And I know that, Danielle, one of the things that you were concerned about is that we were going to have a love fest here and that we're always going to agree with each other, because we do have very similar perspectives, although come at it from a different perspective. But the only other thing I want to share about what I saw in the last couple of years with leaders, the willingness to be vulnerable, absolutely, but to a limited audience. Like, they weren't showing vulnerability to the people in their company because employees were expecting you to have the answer, even if you didn't. The whole notion of VUCA, volatility, uncertainty, complexity, ambiguity, was something that the volatility of what happened, how uncertain everything was, it wasn't an easy fix. The complexity was there. The last piece I want to share about this is March 9th, 2020. I was with a client doing a presentation for their International Women's Day celebration we were talking about, you know, in advance, what is it that we're going to be sharing at this time? And we had done all kinds of stuff on leadership. And I said to them, I said, you know, I've been having this feeling that we really need to be talking about the pace of global change in business and how much more rapid things are happening that leaders have to respond to and manage whether they feel good about it or not. And when I used VUCA, right, volatility, uncertainty, complexity, ambiguity, as my example of how to manage change in the pace of global change right now, my ambiguity was the coronavirus. That was my example. It was new. We didn't really know what it was going to do. Flights to Asia had been shut down. Shipping lines had started to stop bringing goods out of Asia, but it hadn't really hit Europe that hard yet. We were right at the tipping point of basically all hell breaking loose. In those 2 years, and even today, that pace of having to make decisions, not having a tried and true answer, not knowing what's coming next, not recognizing exactly what this was going to do to supply chains, to business as usual. No one had any idea. And yet leaders had to step up. So yes, caring for your employee, being empathetic, listening and so forth, critical. But layer on top of that, the need for speed, the need for decisiveness when you don't have the answers or even a framework to work within because you're, you know, working with something you've never seen before. I think that there's a few, and I know that, well, I think we're going to be talking a little bit about competencies and so forth, but there are a few things that COVID and the pandemic and the civil unrest here in the U.S. really changed the way leaders had to show up every day. And part of it was massively dealing with ambiguity.
These are very moving anecdotes. I mean, we all went through that moment. It's amazing that you could sense that already. And the VUCA for the audience is an acronym that Kelly just unpacked for us. But the A part is about that ambiguity and that you can sense that already at the beginning, that that thing is going to provide a lot of ambiguity to our environment. How will you cope with that?
Business being so global, 2001, when the SARS virus came out of China, we learned about it, but it was maintained mostly, right? But 20 years later or 19 years later, here comes something that because of the way humans are traveling, because of the way business is so interrelated and global, this thing spread like wildfire. Nothing like that has ever happened before. You had to know. You had to. If you were a leader of an organization, it should have been pinging your radar the minute they stopped flying planes to Asia or out of Asia. That right there should have said, we're in trouble. The second clue was shipping lines.
As both of you are commenting about those characteristics of leaders that you have observed. I mean, you've worked with some of the leading organizations or business organizations in the world, each one of you in your own career. I'm going to ask you a question that probably the most asked question in MBA programs all the time, and it keeps going at it, even though people have provided some answers about leaders. There is kind of a myth of the leaders, especially in this country, almost like a worship of leaders, of business leaders. And we put them on a pedestal and then we enjoy destroying them very quickly just after that. There is a myth that in some literature that true leaders, whether they are in politics or in business, which is really our focus, or otherwise, are born, not made. What is your own take? What do you believe in that very simple but with profound implication question? Are leader born or are they made? Or is that both or is that neither? Raj, you want to take a shot at that?
Yeah, no, I believe leaders are developed, you know, leaders are grown, leaders evolve. By the time somebody gets into a position to be a leader, they've experienced a certain amount of life and they've accumulated certain wounds and certain traumas and certain experiences. And unless these leaders are self-aware and unless they are also focused on their own need for healing from those traumas, they will end up being very reactive leaders who get triggered by certain things, right? And they are coming from a place of inner wounds and traumas. I mean, we can think about some of the bad leaders in the world and the people who have done the most damage. I think we find more examples of terrible leadership in the world today than we do great leadership. That's in really short supply. And we can see that all of them are acting out from certain impulses that exist within them that are a result of wounds and traumas. There's a wounded inner child that exists within every cruel leader. And so I think it is a matter of developing yourself. As we say, you need to heal yourself. You need to understand your own triggers. When do you get hijacked? As Carl Jung said, until you make the unconscious conscious, it will drive your life and you will call it fate. So I think everybody can become their own version of a leader once they have done the work. And the work is around self-awareness, knowing themselves, and then loving themselves, which is often a challenge because they have a lot of people are filled with self-loathing because of their conditioning and their parenting and everything else that may have happened to them. And then discovering their unique essence, you know, so being themselves, like, who am I? And how can I then be that and bring that into the world, right? The authenticity, as Bill George has talked about, authentic leadership. So I think it is about every person discovering their own unique purpose that's a function of their qualities that they were born with and to some degree their nurturing, and then becoming whole, so healing the splits that exist within them, and that includes the masculine, feminine, but also includes what I call the elder and child energy, and integrating all of those, and healing. The healing of what needs to be healed. I think we have an epidemic of post-traumatic stress injury in the world. I think everybody has trauma of different kinds. We minimize them, most of us, because we say, we didn't get sent to Afghanistan or Iraq, so what right do we have to complain about, you know, things that happen to us? But the fact is, life is difficult, and there are traumatic things that happen as a matter of course, you know, when you are growing up, and then there are the other things that happen that might be quite distinctive. So there is trauma at every level. There's personal trauma, there's family trauma, there's ancestral trauma, which now we're finding through epigenetics actually is carried forward into our genes from generations ago. We weren't there to experience the trauma of our forefathers, and yet it resides within us. And if you look at every culture, given the extensive history of war and conflict that human beings have had, you know, that trauma exists. In this country, most people have either some trauma that comes from having been enslaved or having been the enslavers, right? In India, it comes from all the caste system and all the abuse and all the rest of it, right? So there's ancestral trauma, and then there's collective trauma. The pandemic, I think Ukraine, the shootings that happen, you know, climate change. I mean, these are all kinds of traumatic things. And so I think what I'm saying is that leaders, the ability to be a leader exists, I believe, in all of us. But there are certain things that hold us back and constrain us from being leaders. But I believe all of those things can be worked on. Because remember, we all have to lead ourselves, right? So whether or not we're ever put into leadership, we have to learn how to lead ourselves. And most people are not good at that. Why? Because they're subject to all of these things that I'm talking about. So once we address all of those and we work on ourselves and become aware of who we are and cultivate those qualities and work on healing ourselves, then I think everybody can become a leader. Now, even within that, some people will have a greater capacity. So there is some degree, just like we have different IQs, right? And that cannot be changed. There are certain other things. So yeah, there are certain attributes that will help us. But I think most of what we are dealing with are things that happen to us and that we can rise above them and heal from them and become the kind of leader that we are meant to be and have the potential to be.
Thank you. Kelly, you have an opinion about that, I'm sure.
I'm sure.
Born and made.
So I think it's both, actually. And I think it's both because I believe that there are leaders at every age and every level of any organization, and even in grammar school, you have people who naturally seem to take leadership roles within schoolrooms and so forth with having no actual training to be that person. It's just a combination of factors that happen to them, whether they, you know, are born with like type A personalities or they have a very high ambition level or things like that, that isn't trained. It's there. And some of the work that we do, we talk about in business, there are leaders at every level, whether they're running a team or not. They could be an individual contributor. So it's really, how do you define leader as to whether it's made or if it's natural? So there are very charismatic people out there who are at any stage of their career who may be a very good leader of people or leader of others or inspiration to people. But then there are those leaders who are made during crisis, who may never have stepped up before, right? So sometimes it's what happens to you. Sometimes it's innate. And then sometimes you can be trained to be a really great leader when different perspectives are given to you and new ideas are brought to you and you have exposure to more people, more ideas, new information. So I kind of think it's not one or the other. It's like there's this beginning that might send you on a faster trajectory. And then there are those who, because of fire or crisis or whatever, step up and become a leader. Raj, I'd love to hear what you have to say about that.
There's research that shows that introverted people actually are very effective leaders in the long run. They have the larger than life personalities and the highly charismatic and so forth, but they're much more rooted in their ego and they might be from a self-serving place, not from a serving place.
Right.
And of course, servant leadership, that's the kind of leadership that is found to actually be more impactful and have a positive impact on the people that you lead and you generate more trust. So I do believe that all kinds of people are capable of being leaders. Yeah. Some people seek it and thrust themselves into those roles. And others, very often the most effective leaders or potentially effective leaders don't seek out leadership.
No, they get dragged kicking and screaming to it.
Yeah, because we've associated leadership with power and ego and, you know, all of those people associate with corruption, right? So as Peter Senge said, power and virtue need to go together. And we've created systems in which the most powerful are not the most virtuous, they're the most ruthless. And then the most virtuous do not seek power because they associate power with
corruption. With all the negative connotations that come with it.
Well, I'm going to ask you to share if you have examples. You don't have to give us a name, but examples in your work as you've interacted with so many leaders, whether it's in industry or in communities or in congregations, doesn't matter. But could you share a couple of key qualities that you have observed in a domain, you tell us, that really either you would expect a leader to possess or you learned from that leader that, oh, that one is important? Can you share such examples with us?
I've been studying conscious leaders for the last couple of decades, you know, and historic figures in business, in politics, but also contemporary leaders. And I've tried to distill what I've learned in terms of what defines them into an acronym, and the acronym is selfless. And the word itself is important because you cannot be a selfish human being and call yourself a leader. I've come to strongly believe that because that means that you're going to look at the people you lead and you're going to see them as ways for you to achieve your personal goals. That I'm going to use all these people to get to whatever goal I have, which is typically defined power and money. So that is the definition of a tyrant. That is not a leader. The true leader is there to take people to a better place. You know, we talked about self-actualization that Maslow had, but then Viktor Frankl talked about self-transcendence. Are you able to think beyond the self to the collective self, right? So I think that is an essential prerequisite. You have to fundamentally be more of a selfless person, that you have an ego, but as the Dalai Lama said, it's a serving ego, it's not a deserving ego, right? That you're coming from that place. And then it stands for the qualities. So it starts with strength. You have to be a strong human to be a leader. And what that means to me is moral courage, which we can see how short supply that is in the world today. How many leaders can we point to? Yes, Zelensky right now, obviously, right? But we can probably name 100 on the other side for people who are shown up as craven and completely lacking in principles, right? And completely opportunistic. You need moral courage and you need personal power, not positional power, right? Not the power that comes from having a title and a chair and all of that, but actually comes from within. So if you think about a Gandhi, Gandhi was never elected to anything, never the head of any organization. He literally had zero positional power. And yet he had extraordinary personal power that came from his own being, right? And how he cultivated himself and the way he taught others to do those and inspired Mandela and King and so many others. So strength is number one. Then energy and enthusiasm. And I think conscious leaders are driven by purpose, driven by something transcendent and important in the world. And that feeds them. That gives them tremendous enthusiasm and energy. And then the next one is love. You have to be rooted in love. And that combination is critical. Strength without love is tyranny. We've had lots of those leaders in the last century, from Hitler and Stalin and Mussolini and Mao and many others in the world today. Love without strength is ineffective. So it's that combination. As Martin Luther King said, we must be tough-minded and tender-hearted. So that combination. Then the F is for flexibility. You have to show up with the right energy in a given situation. You can't be always showing up in the exact same way. And then long-term orientation. You're not thinking just like, I'm going to be CEO for 5 years, so let me just focus on what I can get outcomes in that time, and then I don't worry about what happens later. It has to go beyond your tenure. It even has to go beyond your lifetime. You know, as the Iroquois Confederacy required of their chiefs, you think about the next seven generations. But actually, you think about seven generations, like the 3-4 generations back and 3-4 generations forward. So how do you make sure that you're acting in a way that's aligned with that? And then the last three are different kinds of intelligence. So emotional intelligence, spiritual intelligence, and systems intelligence, right? So knowing yourself, knowing others, systems intelligence, understanding how things are interconnected and interdependent. And spiritual is the role of meaning and purpose in your life and the lives of the people you lead. So that's what I have learned, you know, about this. And I can think about great leaders who exemplify that in the world today. Yeah. You know, we can talk about that if you like.
You put the bar very high, Raj, I must admit. You know, you're selfless. How many of these eight qualities that you listed, and Gandhi and Mandela, those are just human beings trying to go through life. These are very high bars for leaders, but leaders don't have to be Gandhi and Mandela to be leaders, can they? Do they?
You're right. Raj, wow, this is great. I couldn't write this down fast enough. I did. I got it all. And I noticed that you had two E's in self, energy and enthusiasm. So thank you for that. I like this, and I'm going to be quoting you on this at some point, no doubt. But what I wanted to share is, Daniel, I heard what you said, and I think that there's perhaps one word, and you'll have to figure out how to add this to your acumen, that your acronym that's missing, and it's curiosity, right? The desire to learn, the willingness to expose yourself to new situations and new perspectives and so forth. And so to me, curious is absolutely part of the best leaders. And it's those leaders who choose to say status quo, or I've learned everything I need to know to be good at this. No one's going to share with me something that I don't already know. It's that ego you were talking about earlier. Those are the CEOs who fail at some point, whether they fail in the role or they fail shortly after getting out of the role, because they don't recognize how important getting those different perspectives are, and being curious and wanting to know more and exposing themselves to opportunities to get differing perspectives. Those leaders who are so embedded in their own ego, who say, I know everything.
That is a critical one. And that acronym doesn't capture everything, of course. But if you look at probably the leader in the world today that I admire the most in the business world is Satya Nadella at Microsoft. Satya came seemingly out of nowhere, although he had been at Microsoft in different roles. But, you know, he succeeded two larger-than-life characters, right? So there was Bill Gates, and then there was Steve Ballmer. Now, Gates was, of course, the brilliant kind of nerd, you know, arrogant. Somebody came to him with an idea he didn't like. He would say, that's the stupidest thing I ever heard, and don't ever come to me with anything like that. And he created a culture in which everybody kind of became like that, right? Everybody's like a mini-me. Then you had Steve Ballmer, who was like the street fighter. I mean, he was just like pounding the desk and jumping up and down on stage and taking a sledgehammer and destroying a 3D logo of a competitor, and just created like this frenzied energy, you know, and that those 14 years were terrible. Microsoft became almost an irrelevant company in the world and was headed towards death and decline. And then Satya comes along and really reconnects, because they had achieved their purpose, which Bill Gates had articulated, right? A computer on every desk, a compelling vision when he articulated it. And by the time Satya came along, it was pretty much commonplace, right? And having a computer was not an unusual thing. But he created a new sense of purpose. But very importantly, he brought empathy into that culture. Mm-hmm. He modeled vulnerability. At his first offsite meeting with his team, he shared his own challenges in his life. His special needs son, severely disabled, who actually died about a month ago now. His daughter, I mean, it's just his upbringing, everything about himself at a very deep level. Everybody then opened up and they all connected at a human level. And they made empathy one of the key virtues, qualities of Microsoft's culture, right? Empathy for yourself, empathy for each other, and for the customers, and understand their pain. And how can we be part of solving that? But another big thing was what Kelly just talked about, which is a growth mindset. Microsoft was full of smart people who are highly educated and accomplished in their field. And it used to be a sort of a know-it-all culture. Now it's more of a learn-it-all. Everybody is always learning. You have a beginner's mind, right? And you continue to cultivate that all along. And you learn from each other and you learn from outside. So you're constantly growing and evolving, which I think is true even if you're not a leader as a human being. The day you stop growing is the day you start dying, right? So that is something that we as humans should be doing. So yeah, I think they are. And, you know, if you look at the track record, you know, what Satya Nadella has done in his now 8 years as CEO, he's taken that company from $300 billion to $2.3 trillion in market value, like the second most valuable company in the world. No CEO has ever created that much value, but no more than that. It's also on all the other dimensions, right? If you look at their sustainability, environmental side, if you look at diversity, if you look at the future of work, if you look at every dimension, this company is ranked number one on the Just Capital rankings. And it came out of nowhere. I thought Microsoft was an irrelevancy now.
Yes.
Suddenly he's made them into an extraordinary company. It shows the power of leadership.
Exactly. It shows the power of how a single person at the right time understand the zeitgeist basically of that time and can change the direction of a company, you know. 2.3 trillion is not a bad number. But the ability or the willingness to learn, I think the curiosity, Kelly, that you bring us, it's a wonderful addition. I wonder whether or not, as part of this whole construct of selfless, and which I took notes too, and I will quote you to Raj in the future, because I like it. It has the rings of truth. I wonder, actually, as part of that, you mentioned enthusiasm, and Kelly, you also mentioned some positive features as part of this curiosity. Is being optimistic a key component of all that, a key dimension, almost like orthogonal to all that, that covers all these dimensions? Just seeing the positive in things.
So, you know what? Many years ago, in an organization I was working in, there was a statement that we used to use, and I'm now that you say it this way, I'm desperately trying to put it into my head, but it was about seeking abundance as opposed to looking at
scarcity.
Scarcity. Thank you. Yes. Yeah. And so in a way, it is about being optimistic, but it's about recognizing, I think, and this has proven very successful for my career, is recognizing that it isn't an or, it's an and, right? How can we make sure, from an optimistic standpoint, from a view it as abundance, as opposed to saying there's only so little and I'm going to hang on to it with both hands. And so having optimism and being curious and the growth mindset, as you say, Raj, all of those things makes people want to know more. And when we limit, whether we do it ourselves or someone limits it for us, the opportunities to do that, we miss so many innovative ideas and putting something that we just learned over here together with something we already knew that gets us so much further along the way than if we weren't looking for new information.
Thank you for listening to MindWorks. This is Danielle Surfati. Please join me again for the next episode. We welcome your comments and feedback, as well as your suggestions for future topics and guests. We love to hear from you. You can tweet us at MindWorksPodcast or email us at MindWorksPodcast@gmail.com. MindWorks is a production of Aptima Incorporated. My executive producer is Ms. Deborah McNeely, and my audio editor is Ms. Lindsay Howland. To learn more and to find links mentioned in this episode, please visit aptima.com/mindworks. Thank you.